We're in November now. Thanksgiving is just weeks away, and you don't really have a lot of time. You think you do, but you don't. Take it from the butcher's son, me. You need a fresh turkey. So our friends, Stell and Ben of Joseph's Finest Meats, went on a turkey hunt, hunting for the best turkey, and they found it. Yorty Turkey Farm, finest turkey in all the land. How do I know this? Because I know the quality that they demand. At Joseph's Finest Meats, these guys are about quality product. No preservatives, no hormones, no fillers. And when you're having Thanksgiving, you want to treat your family to something that they won't forget. That's why I'm getting my Thanksgiving turkey at Joseph's Finest Meats, 7101 West Addison Street on the northwest side of Chicago, at Addison and Nordica. A family tradition since 1977, and proud sponsor of JohnCastNews.com and the Chicago Way podcast. When you hear pundits talk, and I know because I am one, you can sense when they don't know what's going to happen. They kind of freak out on the panel shows. They kind of walk around and touch and try to feel their way like blind men in the darkness to get a consensus. But there is no consensus. It hasn't happened yet. We're talking Mondami. We're talking the future of the Democratic Party. With Charles Lipson, Professor Emeritus, University of Chicago, Peter B. Ritzma Chair. You can find all his stuff, all his writings, at charleslipson.com. He is the professor that I wish I had when I was a kid. And Jeff Carlin is here. Jeff Carlin, future physics teacher, baker of pies that I haven't had pie in so long. And me, I'm John Cass, editor of John Cass News, where you always get a good cup of Midwestern common sense. And where are you? As Mondami smiles, as the Democratic Party begins to quake, you're on the Chicago Way podcast on WGN Plus.
So this is a guy who lives high on the hog, and he has this Tammany Hall style attitude to power. And it's the Chicago Way, absolutely.
Look, the Chicago Way is a deep cultural phenomenon.
It's the Chicago Way.
The Chicago Way. That's the focus.
In a tower by the river, there lived a man. There was a man who took a stand. With pen and paper in his hand, defeating foes in every ward with a pen more mighty than the sword. No escape from his ink lasso in a tower by the river, Castle.
Here's how you get him. He pulls a knife, you pull a gun. He sends one of yours to the hospital, you send one of his to the morgue. That's the Chicago Way.
No, there's nothing I like better. At a time of uncertainty, when the people are clamoring and wringing their hands, help me, help me, help me find the way. The best way is to listen to Charles Lipson on the Chicago Way podcast. And that's what we're going to do today. Charles Lipson, Professor Emeritus, University of Chicago, our friend, and a graduate of a great school in the South, Ole Miss, joins us on the Chicago Way. Good morning, Charles.
Well, I appreciate that introduction. I feel like a GPS after you've told me I can find the way. I didn't go to Ole Miss.
Oh, great.
No. Do you want to do it over?
No, go on. Come on, I'll make a fool of myself.
I'm sorry. I didn't go to Ole Miss, but I live two towns away. And I used to go over to Ole Miss all the time. To watch the football games, and then the older brothers and sisters of all my friends were going there, and so forth. But I lived in a little town of 2,000 people that was two towns away, and I visited Ole Miss this summer, actually. It's one of the interesting things about sort of where Americans are living now is that virtually all these college towns, Ann Arbor, Bloomington, Indiana, Oxford, Mississippi, have all become these wonderful places that people are going to live in. They are all booming.
Right.
I think one reason is that the smaller towns like Oxford, Mississippi, you can live in a smaller town with the advantages of that, but they have the cultural qualities of a city that is five times, six times as big.
Bingo.
You know, it has all the musical acts and theater and speakers and everything. And I have a first cousin and dear friend who lives in Bloomington, Indiana. The only thing wrong with Bloomington now is that for some reason they have a good football team, and that's not right.
I'm not used to that being a transplant to Indiana. I can't get my mind over the fact that it's IU is a football school, not a basketball school.
When you have Indiana playing better football than the University of Michigan, you know that the world is turned upside down.
That's your rubric. Okay.
So where did you go to school, undergraduate?
Well, I went to high school in this little town in Mississippi, and then I went to Yale as an undergraduate, and then got my PhD at Harvard. The story, John and Jeff, is that you can always tell a Yale man, but you can't tell him much because he'll try to talk over you.
Well, we'll keep that in mind. We'll keep that in mind.
Okay. I had a great undergraduate education.
You had a roommate too. Who's your roommate again?
Well, no,
the guy on your floor was a biographer of Hamilton, if I'm not mistaken.
Well, that's right. My friend Ron Chernow.
There you go.
And I'll tell you, since we're on effectively on the radio, I bought all my furniture in the junior year from a guy who was a senior. And he was Edward R. Murrow's son.
Huh.
And I love those. You listeners to the Chicago Way should know that you can go on YouTube and you can look up Edward R. Murrow, London, and you can hear some of the most fabulous radio broadcasts ever made.
Sure.
When radio was radio, Charles.
Well, right. And one of the things that Edward R. Murrow did on those broadcasts was he not only set the stage like the old baseball announcers did when it was just radio, he really explained what was at stake in the early stages of the war. And he was almost alone in London, among American broadcasters. Most American stations didn't want to broadcast the war in Europe, not because it was expensive to send people over, but because they thought it might involve the United States in the war, and they wanted to stay out of it. This was, of course, at the same time, since we're the Chicago Way, roughly the same time that an America First rally was occurring as soldiers, right, led by Charles Lindbergh, to keep America out, and with a lot of German Americans who favored Germany even at the time. They changed, of course, when we entered the war, but it was a sad situation.
Well, when do we gather our loins and proceed over to Nigeria to begin calling the Christian soldiers to war?
I am so glad that President Trump has called attention to that mass slaughter. And it's not only happening in Nigeria. In a lot of these countries, which are just south of the Sahara Desert, the northern part of the country has an Islamic population, and the southern part has a Christian population. And the Islamic population has now been essentially taken over by these militant Islamicists, and they're just killing Christians by the tens of thousands. And on American campuses and so forth, you hear talk about a non-existent genocide in Gaza. I mean, there's been a lot of slaughter in Gaza, but I mean, the actual genocide that's taking place in Africa is ignored, and the jailing of millions of Muslims, Uyghurs, in China is largely ignored. And it's just this kind of selective outrage.
That's could define most of the communication in the last 10 years, I think, online, is that there's – and I think social media has something to do with that because people get siloed. But is why do we think that this has gone on so – you know, who's funding this? Like what's the power behind this? Because these groups in all of a sudden just get – come together and decide they're going to lay waste to thousands of Christians. I mean, there's got to be – some first butterfly flaps its wing kind of situation. And I'm not familiar with them. I mean, I know the headlines I've seen, and I've done some research on after it was brought up by the president, but do we know what's going on behind this?
I don't know. I would be surprised if it weren't, if there weren't significant money from the People's Republic of China involved. And the reason is that if you take over these countries, you have a foothold on the continent of Africa. Also,
China wants that.
Right. Also, there's there are gold and diamond mines in some of these countries, and that's important. We don't fully know who is funding turning to the American scene.
Right.
I've been on campuses where there have been so-called spontaneous student uprisings. And it's clear that there is significant funding. And I'll tell you how you can tell. There are expensive tents, the kind of tents that if you and I wanted to go camping, we would say, well, that tent is a little too expensive for me. And there are dozens and dozens of them, identical tents.
Industrial.
Right. And somebody's paying for them. And then what I saw at the University of Chicago, which had, compared to some of the other schools, relatively small demonstrations like this, but I saw older adults, mostly men, walking around with very large umbrellas, which they could use almost as a spear to intimidate and keep people away, but they could also unfold the umbrella to prevent you from photographing.
I've noticed this technique. It's very interesting. Yeah, I've seen it.
It is, and that's Antifa. At least the technique was pioneered by Antifa, and somebody was these older people. It's one of the reasons why you've seen a lot more of these demonstrations in urban areas and not in rural areas. And of course, you hadn't seen them at universities in the South. And one of the reasons, if we'll go back to Ole Miss and University of Georgia and so forth, you're seeing a massive shift as parents are sending their children to these universities in the South where there's going to be less disruption.
They want the kids to be safe. And
right.
If you, I don't know where you send your kids. If you're a Jewish parent, where do you send your kids? I don't know. Perhaps to the South.
Well, yes. Well, you're not sending them to Harvard, and you're not sending them to Columbia.
Oh, definitely not, and not New York. Yeah, not NYC.
Exactly. And this is a very troubling development. I mean, there had always been this anti-Semitism on the right, and it had largely faded. And I want to give credit to the key person who did the most to eliminate that on the right, and that's William F. Buckley.
Explain that. I know who William F. Buckley is, but why do you say that? Explain it for the younger crowd, meaning me.
Well, I'll tell you something, Jeff. They're all getting to be younger than me.
But, I know, and me now too. That's what's scary.
Because Buckley ran the National Review, and it was a great magazine, and he decided to go after the John Birch Society. He did not want the John Birch Society to be representative of the conservative movement. But
that's exactly right.
And please, Professor.
And that was not only because, I mean, they were, what they shared, the John Birch Society was aggressively anti-communist, and so was Buckley. But across the right-wing spectrum, there was a lot of anti-Semitism.
Right.
Now, I'm not talking about the Ku Klux Klan and so forth, which was active in Mississippi when I was growing up. Mm-hmm. They were always outside the pale. But the Birch Society really wasn't. It. Some people thought they were outside the pale and some people didn't. And Buckley, who was the single most important sort of intellectual and public speaker for the right, having started this great magazine, which continues, National Review, he decided to take a stand on that. And he did, and he excluded and publicly did so and made a big point of it that being against the Jews just as an anti-Semite was outside the pale. And what you can see now is the rise of this and the conspiratorial views and so forth, and the leading figure for a lot of that is Tucker Carlson. And you're seeing, and then you saw over the weekend that the head of the Heritage Foundation, Kevin Roberts, defended Carlson. And so what you're seeing now is the pushback against that. And I couldn't help but think of Bill Buckley and his important work and what he would have said about figures like Tucker Carlson.
With over three decades of serving up streetwise insight and local perspective on Page Two, the voice of John Cass has a home at johncassnews.com.
There's a new sheriff in town.
This will truly be the golden age of America. That's what we have to have.
But as he settles in, can you deal with the hysteria, the meltdowns, the constant whining?
I don't know what to do.
You know what you need? You need a good cup of common sense.
It's just common sense.
Like the kind of common sense you get when you subscribe to John Cass News. News.com. I'm John Cass, 40 years a journalist in Chicago.
The Chicago way.
I opened this website, John Cass News, so that you could have a decent cup of common sense.
This great country of ours was built on its entrepreneurial spirit.
It's time that you join the frontier of independent journalism at johncassnews.com.
Subscribe today to get access to great columns from John Cass, Dan Proft, and others. Don't be a chum alone and subscribe at johncassnews.com.
The easy thing for some to do and the left to do is to scream out anti-Semitism when there is no anti-Semitism. And I find that to be damaging to the issue. They tried it on me, the Chicago Tribune Guild, which is listing far to the left and destroying the newspaper. They called me an anti-Semite and demanded that I go to some sort of struggle session where I appeal to their mercy, which I would never do. And just so happens that Charles Lipson was one of the defenders of John Cass. Thank you, Charles. The check's in the mail. Yeah.
Well, right. It was just such an effort to marginalize you for other reasons. In particular, there was a union movement at the newspaper, and you were not required to join the union because of your job at the newspaper, but
right.
You were also the only sort of prominent conservative voice at what had once been a conservative paper, and they wanted to go after you.
Right.
For all those reasons, and they picked what they thought was an unanswerable charge. And the charge was that you had used terms like Soros prosecutor. Now, today, everybody uses that because George Soros has sponsored so many of these prosecutors across the country who let criminals out. And, because Soros himself comes from a Jewish background, people would call him a Jew, whether he thinks of himself that way or not, I don't know.
I would point that out, yes. I think he's more of a secular.
Yes, but the point is the people who are damning him some are damning him because they think he is Jewish. That is, they think of it as part of their own anti-Semitic crusade. And they were trying to say, because you just used the term, you were part of that. But it was all specious. And it was malicious.
Thank
it was
you.
Worse than specious. It was malicious.
Mm-hmm.
And John deserved. Now, I favored sending John out to one of the Chinese labor camps to harvest food, because we all need food. And I favored sending John out of Chicago to Indiana, where he would no longer contaminate people with his crazy views. But still, I felt like this was wrong.
But even from here, I can see out here in Indiana, Green Acres, Indiana, that's the real name of the place.
Name redacted.
Is that I can see a friend of mine, Michael Ledwith, one of the writers from John Cass News, just sent me an ad showing me that the Tribune is now giving itself away for a subscription of a year. It only costs $3.
Well, that's overpaying.
Yeah. Go woke, go broke.
One of the terms you mentioned earlier was siloing.
Yeah, Jeff did.
There's a kind of mutual reinforcement to the technological changes in media, where you can now pick, not only sites, you don't go to John Cass News if you're also listening all the time to MSNBC, right?
Yeah.
But it's also
no, because there's a thing, I won't allow people to listen to MSNBC and then me. You have to make a choice.
Yeah, I was going to say my two favorite broadcasters are John Cass and Jeff Carlin, and just behind them is Rachel Maddow.
There you go.
But it's also the case that if you go to something like X, formerly Twitter, the feed that you see is now all reinforcing. They pick what you've clicked on before, and whether it's left, right, center, it could be athletics, whatever it is, and that's all you get.
And it's not just your Twitter. I mean, people, I don't think it's the way you get to the internet. I mean, your internet itself, your provider will start feeding you ads for things that are more linked to that, and you'll see more content.
Yeah, your search engine and so forth.
And it's even beyond the search engine. It's your actual your internet provider, because your internet provider sees where you go. And then they are usually, let's say, AT&T. Well, they own, they're part of a huge conglomerate. So then that conglomerate kicks in. Or if you're a part of Xfinity, they're part of Comcast and they're part of NBC. Right. And so becomes so almost ethereal in the mindset that it's everywhere, and it impacts everything. And it tints your entire world perspective, perception's reality.
And some are doing it for political reasons.
Right.
But a lot of them are just doing it for commercial reasons.
Right.
I mean, if they know that you're interested in the Chicago Bears, they're not going to have your Twitter feed is not going to be filled with stuff about the New York Jets.
Mm-hmm.
They're gonna pick up on what you like, and if you like Republicans, they're gonna feed you that kind of thing. If you like Democrats, they're gonna feed you that kind of thing. And at a time when the country is splitting more and more, this reinforces it, and it's hard to know which comes first. It's a chicken and egg problem.
Right. Yeah, and it's demographic. I mean, it's geographic. It's all sorts of weirdness. And if your neighbor is in an apartment building, and everyone around you is completely liberal, then you're gonna get more liberal things, because they're gonna say, well, chances are, if that whole region, and it's just so it takes over your
along those lines, as it's getting harder and harder to poll people, as you know.
Yeah.
Polls are less accurate.
Sure.
People don't, because especially people don't want to answer online. They don't think it's anonymous, for just the reasons that you and I were saying. And they don't pick up the phone in the same way if it's an unknown caller. But one of the things that that pollsters now are doing in order to get more honest answers is they're saying, Jeff, I'm glad you're taking our poll. We're not going to ask you how you're going to vote in the New York mayor's race, but how do you think your next door neighbor is going to vote? And they take that as a proxy for how you will vote, not only because you're probably living next to somebody who has similar views, but more likely because you're going to give an answer that's accurate, but that you think kind of masks your own preference.
It's a wild time to be alive. And that's, and I know, you know, that's why you can't blame people sometimes for this type of stuff, because it is so
insidious
and all encompassing. And so I feel like that needs to be something we lean on in education to say, like, hey, you gotta consider the source every time, you know, every time you see anything.
Absolutely. But that's a hard world to live in, don't you think?
It is. You know, it's tiring.
Everything. I think the most disturbing thing in our educational system, and I think it's also now part of the political system, especially on the left, but you see it on the extreme right as well, is that these are people who fundamentally don't think America is a good country. And that's just, I think America is a great country. That's not to say it's not flawed, but I think that if you think of George Washington primarily as a slave owner, if you think of Thomas Jefferson primarily as a slave owner, if you think of Abraham Lincoln as primarily somebody who thought blacks were inferior, all these things were true. So in that sense, it's not totally false. What makes it false is that it's not the whole story. Indeed, it's not the dominant story, and it shouldn't be the way that we teach the next generation to think about the country. It's a fundamentally good country, and it can be a better one if you reform it according to the ways that you think would make it better.
But pardon me, gentlemen, the foundational date of the United States, I thought was 1776, but it's been pounded into my rather now soft brain that it was 1619.
Right.
And that's what the left has been.
And why do they say that, John? What happened in 1619 as they see it?
They see it as the United States was founded on the slave trade. The first ships came from Africa. By the way, the human chattel were sold by the king of Ghana, right? And the West Africans, where we have these troubles now. And
right.
And that's what the New York Times and the left, Stacey Davis Gates, all of them are about. They want to promote the United States in its worst terms. Because, well, that's what the left is. They hate the United States.
Well, the 1619 Project wasn't some very marginal project put out by you know, the East Bupkis Weekly News. It was sponsored by the New York Times.
Yeah.
I worked for that with that kid. Dean Baquet was the editor. He used to be at the Tribune. He loved beautiful silk ties. I remember that about him.
Wow, so it can't be all bad. Well,
his dad was a restaurant guy from, owned a place called Eddie's in New Orleans, a famous restaurant. And Dean was a son of the middle class, but then he was captured by the left, I guess.
He ascended.
Is that what it is? Yeah,
I guess.
This is also a puzzle to me, not the people who like all of us kind of make a living having opinions and writing about them and so forth. But why does a kid who grew up in Winnetka or Shaker Heights or Scarsdale, whose mother is a surgeon and whose father works for a corporate law firm, why does that person think that they're exploiting anyone? Why do they think that they're...
I mean, that they themselves are guilty of exploiting. Yes.
Exactly. Why? I'm not saying that people to whom much is given don't have responsibilities to give to the poor and all the rest, to help out if they can as volunteers and so forth. But why do they feel that they're responsible in some way for people who aren't doing well, not doing well?
The thing you haven't either of you come to grips with, or at least for the purposes of our discussion, is the self-loathing. You touched on it, Professor, the self-loathing of the middle class.
Yeah.
Like, look at New York now.
Yes.
There's a class in New York, an educated class. You've taught them, Professor. You've seen, you know them, and they feel that they're educated, and so they're owed something. They feel that they want to live better than they are living, because, like, to me, $300,000 would be good, but not to not if you're going to live in Manhattan. That's not, the money is too. And so they talk about affordability and some other nonsense that they keep pushing, which is just,
well, affordability is a real issue for people,
but it's just to mask what they want, what they're trying to do.
Exactly. They've grasped that issue. I must say that there's a romanticism on the left. You saw it in years ago with Che Guevara t-shirts and
John Lennon, working class hero. That's what Jeff is writing down right now to put that in at the end of
I don't think
podcast.
We're gonna get the rights to that one, John.
Right. Well, those guys, actually the Beatles, were at least raised in poverty. Mondami, it is a very puzzling phenomenon, but I will say the fact he's very articulate. He's always smiling.
Why?
And I've never seen a guy. I mean, you know, you'd have to give me lots of drugs to smile that much. But if you went by who would benefit, then I would say his whole election is going to be sponsored by Miami and Dallas. Right. I mean, it's just,
well, he's the real estate king
realtor of the month for all of Florida. And what you're seeing, and you see this for Chicago too, that Dallas is becoming a real financial capital. I saw recently that JP Morgan now has more employees in Texas than in New York. Now, New York is still the world's financial capital, and it's very hard to move that. But the fact is, it's not only that in Texas you have no state income tax, and in California they now, for example, want to not only increase the taxes on the wealthy, which are now, I think, at 13% on top of your federal tax. They want to begin a wealth tax, so they would go after people who have more money, but those people would be like J.B. Pritzker, right? They would hide their money in offshore things, and they would move the toilets out of their homes or do whatever they needed to do to cut their tax rate. Those are the people, the very wealthy, who are in the best position, and they would move out of the state as their principal domicile.
So what is all this going to do? Assuming that Mondami wins, what does it do to the Democratic Party? I think Barack Obama will be replaced by the cult of Mondami.
Ooh. Well, the first thing you can say is that if Mondami wins in New York, and if the Democrat wins in either New Jersey or Virginia or both, all the Democratic talking heads on TV who are not part of the far left will try to say that Mamdani is not the face of the Democratic Party. No, we're a broad tent. We have all these people, and they'll call these people and actually Right, Spanberger and Mikey Sherrill have both run very far to the left, but they the national spokespeople are calling them moderates. They will try to do something to make them appear the real spokesman of the party. I think that will fail. And the reason it will fail is that New York is still the media capital of the world, along now with Washington. And then what you're going to see is that Mamdani has never run anything larger than a two-car funeral. He's a young guy with no management experience whatsoever, and all of his policy ideas are proven failures. You can
kind of like the mayor of Chicago.
Well, yeah, there's a reason they call him Mayor 6.6, right?
Right.
That's his approval rating. But the interesting contradiction, and you can see it most clearly in Brandon Johnson in Chicago, is that they claim to love the poor, but they also favor the educational system that has done almost everything to keep the poor poor.
Yeah.
Right? And they favor... Right,
because they're beholden to it.
Yes, and they favor a criminal justice system, so-called, that endangers those neighborhoods. They're just tied up in contradictions. The good news is that that I think that if the far left wins in New York, the party will face a real reckoning, because this is the kind of mayor who can win and has won in Chicago, New York, and L.A., but is not the winning face of a national party.
And the result is what? Then if you're a Democrat running,
Well, you're caught between the dog and the hydrant. And the reason that you're caught between the dog and the hydrant is because you've got to get past the primary. Yeah. You can't get past a Republican primary in almost any state now if Donald Trump is against you. If he picks another candidate, you're toast, right? That's what makes it his party, right? And you can see even in purple states a purple state like Michigan, but you can see that that their Democratic representatives have moved to the left when they should have been moving to the center,
right,
to capture more of the votes. Well, why are they moving to the left? They're moving to the left because they don't want to be primaried.
Right.
And so they go in their own silo.
Right. And that's the reason Republicans don't want to oppose Trump. And even now, I mean, Trump is a lame duck president in the normal sense of the term, but he's not lame duck in the most important sense of the term, namely that the base is still with him, and if you're against him, you're in deep trouble, or if he's against you is more to the point. And so what you have is
Thomas Massey, right?
Right. Well, it remains to be seen if Massey will lose in a primary, but he's unusual. He's standing out there, and you can see it with Marjorie Taylor Greene. She's been beginning to edge out on the far right against Trump, but also on the grounds that she's representing a poor rural population. And so she's been against some of his things, and it remains to be seen if he can defeat them, or will try to. In the case of Green, he will try to defeat Massey.
And it seems like Trump's also the linchpin in pushing Mamdani into the face of the Democrats, because he's probably going to, you know, go after him because it's low-hanging fruit, and it's New York, and he's going to have the ability to do that.
Well, it's his talent.
Right, as I'm saying. So it's going to, you know, solidify Mamdani as this, you know, foil, and then the Democrats are going to come up defending him because, well, if Trump doesn't like it, then I'm going to like him, you know, that kind of thing.
That's exactly right. It's the Chinese finger puzzle.
Right.
They put their finger in and started to pull, and Trump puts his finger in and starts to pull hard in the other direction, and then both sides are locked in. One thing I'll say about Trump is that he is almost a genius in picking his enemies.
Yeah.
They pick him, of course, but sure. What's striking about Trump's enemies is that he often picks the strongest ones. He didn't go after a marginal state university. He went after Harvard. He right. went after Columbia. Columbia's already caved. Harvard is trying hard to not cave. And well, what you see on a lot of other universities is them trying to sort of keep their head low. But he goes after strong opponents, not weak opponents. He's not afraid of doing that.
I really don't have much to say other than that. And I'm always willing to, as we said, to have Charles Lipson here, because we must, as the Jacobins say, encourage the others. And I just love that phrase. It's from Candide, the killing of an admiral who made a political mistake.
Yeah.
And
why did you do it
to encourage the others? Right. Exactly.
That's exactly right. Well, the threat of hanging in the morning does encourage the others. And, so does the idea of just going along with everybody else. And if I was going along with anybody, it would be you, John and Jeff.
Oh, thanks, Charles.
I would throw rolls at you guys on the way up.
Good for you.
Thanks, Charles. Always an honor.
My pleasure.
For Charles Lipson, Professor Emeritus, the University of Chicago, the Ritzma Chair, you can find all his work at charleslipson.com. That's LIPSON.com. For Jeff Carlin, future physics teacher, my friend, baker of pies, lover of cats, married to the lovely Christine. And for me, John Cass, editor of John Cass News, we always get a good cup of common sense. Join us again next time, won't you, on another edition of the Chicago Way podcast on WGN+.